Now we are released, as the children of Israel were, from symbolic Egypt. We have a full week ahead of us, 7 days, of keeping sin out of our lives. We've had weeks in preparation ahead of time to take leaven out of our homes, to rid our cars of leaven. And of course, you find odd things in odd places going, how in the world did this get here? Hopefully we don't have that this week as we go through the week finding things in places that it shouldn't be. Hopefully all of us have remembered to do particular things, like after vacuuming up all the leavening and the crumbs, to clean out the vacuum cleaner, to not leave it and then realize, oh, it's all been sitting there, or bagging up the trash and you put it somewhere where you can get rid of it and it's sitting there the next day when you find it sitting in your home. We have taken the time to rid ourselves of leaven. And through the examination process, we've taken the time to rid ourselves of sin. And we are to keep that sin out for 7 days. To keep leaven out physically, but to be on guard. The word keep is to guard or to watch. And we watch for sin for 7 days. We have examined ourselves and we've tried to remove anything that we recognized as being leaven spiritually. But we have to keep it out. And so for 7 days, not only do we not eat leaven, and for some they're like, it's easier to not eat any leaven, I just won't eat out and I won't go to the store for a week, than it is to, I won't sin for a week, or I won't have a wrong thought or wrong idea. We have to guard and we have to watch. And hopefully, again, we've gotten all that leaven out of our homes, and we are working on spiritual leaven in our lives. Last night, by keeping the night to be much observed, we were symbolically released from sin, and now we're coming into the first holy day. So what do we do now? As we have gone through that process, we've put the leaven out. Our homes are de-leavened through Passover. Our lives are de-leavened. What do we do now? And what do we do, and what do we focus on for these next 7 days? I want to look at what the Apostle Paul wrote to the Corinthian church, to look at the message that he was giving to them for the Feast of Unleavened Bread. 1 Corinthians chapter 5. 1 Corinthians chapter 5, and beginning in verse 8. He says, therefore, let us keep the feast. Let us keep the feast, not with old leaven, neither with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. He said, we are to keep the feast. We're to guard it. We're to protect it. We're to honor it and hold on to it, but not with old leaven, neither with leaven or malice and wickedness, but of sincerity and truth. When we ask the blessing on the bread at the Passover service, we eat that. We ask the blessing to be a representation of the body of Jesus Christ. We do that one time in a year. When we eat unleavened bread during the week, we don't break a matzo for dinner and we say, please bless this to represent the body of Jesus Christ. We do that at Passover. But we do eat unleavened bread, and there is a reason. So he says we are to keep that feast, but do it with a bread, not as a representation of his body, but as sincerity and truth. The days we keep after the Passover have different meaning, as we look, different meaning to the bread as we look at it. So we don't take in that bread as a symbol of his body. We continue, we know that it pictures being unleavened as he was, but there's more to it. It's a bread of sincerity and truth. Last night, I mentioned as we began the evening, the night to be much remembered or observed, and I mentioned that it is us becoming unleavened. It's not just having a house that's unleavened or bread that's unleavened. The intent and the example and the purpose of these days is that we ourselves, that we become unleavened. Sincerity is part of it. and having the sincerity, having a genuine and true approach to things, but there has to be truth as well. So it says it's of sincerity and truth. So he says, let us keep this feast. Let us keep the days of unleavened bread. And the injunction to keep the feast comes right after telling them that Christ, our Passover, is sacrificed for us. Now, let us keep the feast. So here we are on the first day of unleavened bread. And how are we to keep that feast? See, Paul says here, not with the old leaven, not with the way that we have been living. Now, we know that in the conversion process, you look back and you go, I don't want to go back to that way of life. And there's so much that I have not returned to. But yet, each year through the year, when we examine ourselves, we realize I haven't gotten it all out yet. There's still more of me that needs to change. So he says, not with the old leaven, not with the leaven of things that we've identified as we've examined ourselves, as we've searched the physical home for leaven. We read the back of boxes and we read the ingredients and we go, is that leaven? Because leaven comes in many different names. Is that leaven or is that not leaven? And we work through and remove that. But at the same time, hopefully, we have been looking at ourselves and going, okay, what spiritual leaven needs to be removed? Am I looking at all the ingredients that compose who I am, and am I getting that out of my life? So he says, not with the old leaven. We have to change. The old leaven consists of the old corrupt practices, things that we do, things that we have found when examining ourselves. And hopefully, again, we found things that need to be changed, things that need to be improved upon. We have to change the reason that we think the way that we do, the way that we do things, how we think about things, and what we do. So all of these compose our ingredients when we look at ourselves, and we are to become unleavened. So we have to change our thinking, change the negative aspects of our life. The things that we realize, okay, I shouldn't do that, or that's really not, it may not be a sin, but it's not something that's helping me. What is it that I need to get rid of? What negative aspects need to be removed? But he goes on, he says, neither with the leaven of malice and wickedness. Now, I don't think any of us went, oh, okay, I examined myself, I'm pretty wicked. I have a lot of wickedness in me. But he says, we are not to keep these days with the leaven of malice and wickedness. According to Strong's Concordance, this word malice means badness. Now, I don't think any of us went, I'm bad. I'm full of badness. No, it says badness or malignity, trouble, naughtiness, or wickedness. Now, we could say, well, good, that clears me. I don't think I'm wicked. It means vicious character. It's something that's opposed to excellence, but it has to do with wrong attitudes and wrong motivations. Oh, now we're on a different level where we can say, okay, do I have wrong motivations? Sometimes do we look at and examine situations and go, you know what, my motivation wasn't right behind that. Or I have an attitude about something, or my attitude isn't right about particular things. But then he adds wickedness, and the word wickedness means active form of evil or actions that are evil or actions that are wrong. It comes from a word that means plots, iniquities, or wickedness. It can even just mean sin. We have to keep this feast without that type of attitude and without those type of approaches. Verse 6, Paul says, your glorying is not good. Okay, so now he says, we don't want to keep the feast with malice and wickedness. We don't want to keep it with the old leaven, the old way of life. But then he says something to the Corinthians. He says, your glorying is not good. They were boasting and expressing confidence in their present condition. We're doing pretty well. We're a good church. We've got it on, we got what we need. They were boasting, and it means they were showing conceit or they were bragging about their condition. And it's never a good place to be because it's not a way of looking at ourselves and it doesn't give us a proper perspective of ourselves. But he said they were boasting. And he said, your glorying is not good. You're boasting about yourself for something that you shouldn't be. An example of that now might be, well, this year was easy. I'd examined myself and I'd overcome almost everything. I had a really good year this year. It was so easy to examine myself. Or I've heard people say it was so easy getting the living out of our homes this year. We've never found that yet. Especially if you have little ones, you find leaven everywhere. But I've never had an easy year where leaven was just so easy to get out of the house. Except one particular year. And that was the year that we moved from Visalia to Los Angeles. And we sold our house, cleaned it, packed up everything, and moved here right before the Days of Unleavened Bread and moved into a new house. And so it was clean. The other one was clean. It was a little bit easier move when everything's packed up in boxes and on a truck and you just don't pack any leaven. Made a little bit easier that year. But to have a year where we go, you know what, it was an easy, I've overcome everything already. There might be a little boasting or pride in that. The purpose of examining ourselves is so that we see reality. To look at ourselves and go, yeah, I may have done well this year, I may have grown this year, but what is it still there that I have to remove? And again, we ask God to help us to see that reality, to see things as they are, and not just as we want to paint them. And as individuals with the human mind, with the natural carnal mind that which we are fighting to overcome, we can come up with ideas on our own that we can paint a picture and we go, oh, compared to others, I'm doing well. That's one way of doing it. Or compared to the way I was, I'm way ahead of where I was, but that's still painting a picture. What's the reality? What is it that I need to really remove? I plan to speak on that sometime in the near future about looking at things and the way we examine things. Not just examining ourselves for Passover. We've gone through that. We went into it quite detailed this year. Hebrews 4 verse 12 says, the word of God is living and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the division of soul and spirit, the joints and the marrow. And it says, God's word is a discerner of thoughts and intents of the heart. God's word digs deep. And when we study and we examine ourselves, asking God to show us, he will, through his word, dig into the joints and the marrow. As deep as you can go into the human body. But it says it's a discerner of the thoughts and intents. Not just thoughts. Thoughts can be wrong. Thoughts can be bad. They can be good. But is a discerner of the thoughts and the intents of the heart. What is it that drives us? What makes us think the way we do? Many times individuals will become overconfident because of blessings or because they've gained certain knowledge. And they have an overconfidence in their knowledge or ability. Some become proud of themselves and begin to boast. You know, I've really grown this last year and I feel like I know more than most of everybody else in the congregation. We smile, and I see some of you smiling, but some have said that. And it's like, then there's still a lot to learn. You're thinking in your mind going, that's good, but now you're going to find out some other things as God begins to reveal other parts of your character. But it becomes easier to fall under the influence of Satan when we become overconfident and begin to boast. And having Satan's pride that he did, it's easy for him to recognize that and begin to push that even further with you. He says in verse 6, don't you know a little leaven leavens the whole lump? Even if you only have a little bit of leaven, it's going to leaven the whole lump. So it's not, I removed most of the leaven. If you've ever made dough and you didn't have enough yeast to make a dough, and you go, okay, I'm going to put a little bit more sugars in there to give it something to feed on and to grow. But the little bit of leaven will actually do quite a bit as it begins to work and begins to increase. You can't have a little bit of leaven left over. He says, a little bit of leaven leavens the whole lump. Purge out, therefore, the old leaven. He says, purge out, therefore. Therefore meaning, now that we've looked at it and we've seen and we've examined, purge it out. That old leaven, And he says that you may be a new lump. He doesn't say purge out the leaven, so now you're leaven free. He says you become a new lump. Us individually. It's not just that we observe days of not eating leaven. I think many of us will probably do that without slipping up. And each of us have our stories of when we have. But you become a new lump. And he says, as you are unleavened. These 7 days of unleavened bread is not just avoiding leaven and not eating leavening. He says, you are unleavened. We've come through the Passover. We've renewed that commitment. And many of us appreciate that commitment. And we look forward to it with anticipation, knowing, yes, I'm going before. And that bread and that wine and the foot washing are a renewal of my commitment to Him. And I am cleansed again. We're unleavened. And we are to keep unleavened for this week. It says, remain unleavened as you are unleavened, even as Christ our Passover is sacrificed for us. It's a type of ourselves becoming unleavened. Doesn't that feel nice? To come out of the Passover, to have the night to be much observed, you're around the right people, you're cleansed, you have a new beginning to be free from that. Leavening pictures sin. And as of Passover 2 nights ago, we are sin-free. Unless we've already made a mistake since then, and hopefully if we have, we've repented and gone to God again. Have we stayed sin-free even for 2 days? I was frustrated coming to Night to Be last night, Night to Be Much Observed, because the traffic and people cutting in and out and crossing double yellow lines, and I was like, my daughter was riding with me, and I said, here I am, just come out of the Passover, and I've already got an attitude about the traffic. I have to watch that. Now, I wasn't just ranting and raving and pulling out a pistol, which is also common in this area. But it's something that's upsetting, and I have to watch that attitude. You have to watch. You don't want to go into road rage, but at the same time, you don't want to let it get to you either. And as I've mentioned here, there's times I can calm myself down going, doesn't help to say anything or do anything. It's, you live here. This is what it is. And you start accepting and getting used to that kind of traffic and used to delays. What take you may take you a half hour one time, may take you an hour and a half another time. You realize traffic is going to change. But we have to watch all those little things, and we have to stay unleavened. It's what the next 7 days picture. Building a habit of watching for physical leaven, but even more so, watching for spiritual leaven and staying ourselves unleavened. Verse 7, he says, you are to purge, to clean out, or to clean thoroughly the old leaven. Completely flush it out of the system and get rid of anything that's bad. Now some, unfortunately, over the years, they haven't taken physical de-leavening seriously. They're like, well, you know, the church swung to one end so much that you had to either throw away your toaster or hose it out in the backyard and take it apart with a screwdriver and pick all the little crumbs out of the toaster. And then they swung to the other side saying, well, I don't think, you know, since we were so detailed into the physical, now I'm just going to focus on the spiritual. And they do very little physical de-leavening. And again, it can be either way. There's a purpose, God says, I want you to remove all the leaven. And in today's homes, it's not that we have a one-room home with rounded corners, which if you've ever seen in hospitals, they make hospitals the same way. They have rounded corners so it's easy to mop where things don't get into crevices. But we don't have those kind of homes with just one room and rounded corners. We have to go through detail looking for leaven. And of course, sometimes you go, well, we didn't need any leavening here, but I'm going to clean anyway. And then you find a half a piece of toast or something. You go, how did that get there? Well, there's ways. And sometimes it may just be accidental. Other times you go, that had to be just some odd thing that happened, that a piece of toast ended up behind a dresser or in a particular room that we don't eat in. And again, the stories can go back and forth of what has happened of what we've seen. But again, that's missing the mark. If we don't focus on the physical, if we don't take the physical aspect and the physical lessons of removing it, then we're missing the mark on the spiritual aspects as well. But it represents getting rid of anything that is not of God. We purge out any old or corrupted leaven. In the New Testament, leaven is used metaphorically. It describes corrupt actions or corrupt practices. And we see that even spiritually when we look at it in a spiritual aspect. It's also used for corrupt doctrine. When we look at leaven, it's not just what we have done or physical actions or our thought patterns. It can be corrupt doctrines or where truth has been mixed with error. Bad yeast mixed in with truth. Corrupt doctrines are a leaven that has to be removed. And we have to examine ourselves for corrupt doctrine. We see that even in the church today, and it comes in phases of different things in different years. Calendar issues, new moons, rapture, sea of glass, the meaning and the timing of the holy days. It goes on and on with these things that come around where people get on a bandwagon. Oh yeah, I see what they're saying, and it begins to increase, and then you see it die off because it's not backed by Scripture. But people who think, well, now I've learned something new, I've learned something, and I have the special knowledge nobody else has, goes back onto the pride side. Matthew chapter 16. Matthew chapter 16. And in verse 6. Matthew 16 and verse 6. He says, Jesus said to them, take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. He wasn't saying beware of the leaven that they sell because it's tainted leaven. It's not going to make your bread rise well. Beware of their leaven. They didn't get it from the right place. It's an odd source of yeast or an odd source of leaven. He says, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees. Verse 11, how is it that you do not understand that I spoke not to you concerning bread? Because they're going, okay, well, yeah, their bread must be bad. We can't eat their bread. He said, I'm not talking to you concerning bread that you should beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees. Then they understood how he bade them not to beware of the leaven of bread, but of the doctrine of the Pharisees and Sadducees. Leaven, meaning they had corrupt doctrine. And just as yeast will, a small amount of yeast will leaven an entire lump, a small amount of corrupt doctrine begins to spread as well, begins to grow. And he says, beware of this leaven of corrupt doctrine. And again, the leaders of that day, and what Paul was dealing with, or what Matthew was dealing with here, was corrupt doctrine. I want to look at some other things that Paul said to us and explains to us in his message to the Corinthians. Let's go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, because it represents the lessons and a legacy of what these days historically picture, the type that is there for us to learn from. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 1. He goes back and talks about the forefathers, the journey that they made from Egypt or from sin. He says, verse 1, moreover, brethren, I would not have you, or would not that you should be ignorant, how that all of our fathers were under the cloud and all passed through the sea. Verse 6 tells us all these things happen for examples, that the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they lusted. This chapter was written to them as a lesson and a warning, and that same lesson and warning is there for us today. So he says, they all passed under the cloud and through the sea. But he starts off, I don't want you to be ignorant or unaware of these particular lessons. This is what Paul is telling the Corinthians. This isn't back in the Old Testament when it happened, but here he's teaching the New Testament church. And he says, I want you to understand these lessons. Remember and learn from them and what they did so we don't repeat it. It's not about needing water. No, we don't have any water out here. You brought us out here to die. It's not about complaining about meat. We're tired of manna. Can you give us roasted quail, rice pilaf, a little bit of leeks on the side? It's not about complaining about meat. It says they were under the cloud. Now, today we might think of that as a negative term. Somebody tells you, yeah, I've been under the cloud today. They're not saying that Jesus Christ was following them and they felt protected. You know, when we think of being under the cloud, sometimes today it's a negative term where people, you know, I'm feeling down, under the cloud. But it says here that they were under the cloud, meaning that Shekinah glory, they had God's glory over them. His presence was with them and His protection was with them. It's a very special place to be. They were in a relationship with Jesus Christ because He was the one that was with them. It says they passed through the sea and the waters were over them. The waters was on both sides, a cloud above them. They were immersed. And it was divine proof that God was with them. It says verse 2, they were all baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea. Clouds are made up of water, so the water was over them, the water was on both sides. If God would have allowed that water to come together, they would have drowned just like the Egyptians. They were baptized. They were immersed under the cloud and in the sea. Baptized means immersed. So they were immersed in the Red Sea. And as God brought them out of the sea, their past, physically and symbolically, was washed away and buried. Now, that included the Egyptians, included the sin that followed them very quickly. And maybe you have examined yourself. We've got to the Passover. We have the night to be much observed. We're relaxing, but you realize sin is right at the door. It's following us. But symbolically, their captors were also destroyed, and the sin that followed them was removed. Egypt was no longer able to claim a hold on them. It's the place where we are today after the Passover and after the night to be much observed last night. We are freed from sin. We've come through the process. Now we are unleavened, and we are to keep the days of remaining unleavened. Verse 3 said they did all eat of that same spiritual meat. God supernaturally fed them manna from heaven. They were nourished in a remarkable way by a food that didn't exist. God gave it to them each day, and each morning there was a reminder when that food was there, when the manna was there, that God was blessing them and taking care of them. They were shown how special that relationship was. He also taught them spiritually. It says they all ate the same spiritual meat. It's not talking about the quail. Verse 4 says they all drank of that same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. He was with them. It's interesting, we take the Passover and we understand that he says, my body is meat indeed and my blood is drink indeed. They did a physical eating of what God provided and drank of that same spiritual rock which was Christ. And at Passover, he says, my body is the meat and my blood is the drink. They were provided for supernaturally in a desert where normally food doesn't exist like that. But he provided all of their needs. And the one who became Jesus Christ was right there with them, taking care of them all the way. It's another deceptive leaven that has crept into some organizations, that Jesus Christ is not the God of the Old Testament, that Jesus Christ was created being, that Jesus Christ wasn't the one who led them, when it's very clear that he was. And even Paul's message, he said, that rock that followed them, that was Christ. They had spiritual meat. They had spiritual drink, just as we have. Numbers 20 tells us that we have an account of how God enabled Moses to draw water from a rock. Now we know he, instead of speaking to the rock, he struck it. But it provided water for the Israelites. And in spite of all that, in spite of providing water, in spite of providing manna and quail, they failed to remain faithful. They failed to follow through on their commitment. All that you have said, we will do. Verse 5, 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 5 says, "But with many of them God was not well pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness." So we have the contrast of they started off great, they were excited. I talked about earlier the excitement of coming out of Egypt and that would have, what that would have been like to have been free from slavery. And now all of their brethren, the Hebrews, were leaving and they were excited. And God performed miracle after miracle in Egypt before they left, and then to provide for them as he did on their journey. So it started off good, and he was present with them, but most of them never made it to the promised land, including Moses. They were dead and buried in the wilderness. And why? It says God was not pleased with them. God provided the blessings. He took care of all their needs. He was there with them, and yet they continued to sin, and they lost out on the opportunity to be in the promised land. So Paul says, these things happen for examples for us, that we don't do what they did. Verse 6 says, all this happened to them as examples for us. And again, they are to become our example. An example can be either a good example or a bad example. And he says, these are there for examples. God was not happy with them. Don't do what the Israelites did. What was the intent of that example? We know that history repeats itself, and there's historical types. And we can look back, and many have said, well, the children of Israel, they really didn't get it. And they made all these ridiculous mistakes. And how could they do that when God was so clearly with them? But that happens today, doesn't it? Individuals who have miracle after miracle in their life, and they go, you know, it's not working out for me. And they make some of those same mistakes. He says, learn from their example. Learn from the good things that they did, but also learn from the mistakes. Now it says the intent, he says, to the intent. This is why we learn from the examples. To the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they lusted. Now, he didn't say lust after water and quail, or lust after going back and having the leeks and the onions and the garlic. He says, don't lust after evil things as they lusted. Don't be, verse 7, idolaters. Neither be idolaters as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat, drink, and rose up to play. This is after all the miracles, after being led through the sea and being immersed with the cloud above and the water on the sides. It says, they sat down to eat, drink, and rose up to play. And he's talking about this being idolatry. Moses was in the mountains receiving the Ten Commandments from God, and the people had so little faith and so little trust. They're like, he's been up there too long. We need to start doing things different. We need to change. We don't have faith that Moses is going to come back. And it says, when Moses delayed his coming, the people rose in a mob and persuaded Aaron to make a golden calf of the idols of those that were around them. He said, give me your jewelry. And of course, we know the story. I love the ridiculousness of the story. They gave me their gold. I threw it in the fire and out came this calf. That was an easy way of creating a calf. You just throw all the gold in, and he didn't say it walked out, but out came the calf. It may have shocked people to see it walk out. But he formed it. They formed it of the gods around them, and they worshipped calves in Egypt. But the people wanted something that they could see. Now, even today, individuals make idols of the things around them. And even today, as I talked about Moses and Christ and the types between them, just as people cried out then, Moses delays his coming, I'm going to do something different. How many people have said, Christ is delaying his coming? How come Christ doesn't return? Or I've been in the church 30 years and he hasn't returned yet. Is this really true? They're saying the same things. He delays his coming. The miracles coming from God, they couldn't see, and it bothered them. They didn't correlate, we don't just create a God and that'll be the miracles, that'll provide us the miracles. No, they lost the ability to see God for what he was. Today there's numerous miracles, and even today people say, well, we don't see miracles. I don't see things happening anymore like happened with the New Testament church, happened with the children of Israel. But Jesus Christ even told his disciples, he said, blessed are your eyes for they see. And he says, you haven't seen and you believe. He said, that stands for something more. You don't have to have something physical in front of you to be able to see it. How many today have turned away because Jesus Christ has delayed his coming? If we've been in the church for decades, you know that many have. Each of these things were prevalent in the church at Corinth. Corinth was a center of Diana worship. They had many idols. And he says, don't be idolaters. He's telling the Corinthian church, but Paul's message was, this is examples for us, and it is examples for us today. Still the same church. Today we see different types of idols. Not the same idolatry that we saw or that we see in Corinth. Idols today are everywhere, but sometimes it's more subtle. People don't realize that what they're worshiping is an idol. An idol can be anything that takes the place of the true God. Paul tells the Corinthians they were puffed up and they were full of vanity and pride. He warned them against that. And here he's warning them that they weren't above such things. He said, don't become idolaters. He's speaking to the church. He was telling them to be on guard, and we are to be on guard as well. Verse 8, he says, neither let us commit fornication as some of them committed and fell in one day 3,000. When they rose up to play, Paul says, do not commit sexual immorality. And that was rampant in Corinth, and again, maybe even more today than it even was in Corinth. But the city of Corinth had temple prostitutes as part of the religion. And individuals would frequent the temple and feel religious or feel righteous because this was all part of the practice, part of the worship. He says, neither, verse 9, let us tempt Christ as some of them were also tempted and were destroyed by serpents. They tempted Christ. And again, this is even more when we look at, was Jesus Christ the God of the Old Testament? Paul says they tempted Christ. He knew who it was. They tempted Christ. And how did they tempt him? Well, they griped and complained about everything they didn't like. If you had just been delivered from slavery, save somebody from slavery. You got them out of slavery. You fed them. You clothed them. You took care of them. And then they griped and complained. You haven't done enough for me. How come you're not giving me this? How come you're not giving me steak? You freed me and you gave me food. You gave me clothes. But how come I don't have nice juicy prime rib like we had last night? No, we can't complain and gripe. And they tempted Christ. They accused God of bringing them up to the wilderness to kill them. First time God put up with it, and sometimes we can go by without correction, but after a while we are going to be corrected. We are going to be punished. Numbers tells us that they journeyed from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to compass the land of Edom, and the soul of the people was much discouraged because of the way. This is too far. You can hear little kids. Are we there yet? I wonder how many people followed Moses. Are we there yet? Are we there yet? How much longer till we get there? They were discouraged because of the way. The people spoke against God, and they spoke against Moses. Wherefore have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? There's no bread, there's neither water, and our souls loathe this light bread. They said, we're hungry and all we have is Rye Krisps. I've mentioned Rye Krisps before. That as a child, that was my lunch when I took it into my lunchbox to school. And a Rye Krisp to me was the smell of it, the feel of it, that hard, brittle. But if you were hungry and that's what you had, it would be a blessing. They said, our souls loathe this light bread. The Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, and many of Israel died. We don't want to complain. The people became discouraged. They became upset. And when that happens, usually bad things will follow. But they accused Moses and they accused God of trying to kill them. Yet in spite of all this, every morning when they got up, there was manna. And each day, the pillar of cloud was there to shade them. It was still with them. And each night, the pillar of fire was still there. Reminds me of the passage where he says, while you were yet sinners, Christ died for you. He wanted the people to succeed. How many of us still complain when in fact God is providing all the basic needs that we have? Well, why can't I have a new car? How come I'm not getting a higher paying job? How come I don't get to serve in a position at church? How come my company's not giving me a raise or giving me a promotion? God taking care of all of our needs, and are we grumbling and complaining? Paul goes on verse 10, he says, neither murmur as some of them also murmured. Don't complain as they complained, and they were destroyed of the destroyer. Don't grumble and complain. Does anyone do that? I mentioned sometimes I grumble and complain about the traffic. And yet, all the blessings and all the other things that God provides, I have to realize it doesn't do any good to grumble about the traffic. I haven't been hit. I haven't been, with all the bad traffic and all the bad drivers, it hasn't happened. So I shouldn't complain about the traffic. But he says, don't grumble and complain. And yet our forefathers, by the example they gave us, complained and they grumbled. And in spite of what God had done for them, they were consumed with themselves, what they wanted, and not what God was doing and what God was providing for them and where God was leading them. Let's go to Numbers chapter 16. Numbers chapter 16 and verse 1. Numbers 16 and verse 1. Now Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, and the son of Levi, and Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab and On, and the son of Peleth and Reuben, took men. Now, you think, well, why did it list all these people? It was listing some of the leaders that were there. They took men, and they rose up before Moses with certain of the children of Israel, 250 princes, individuals of stature, princes of the assembly, famous in the congregation, men of renown. If we get these people, everybody's going to get on board, believe us. They're going to get on our side because we've got people that are known. We've got some names in there. So they were name dropping. They were grabbing people who would stand out. And it says they gathered themselves together against Moses and against Aaron. And they said to them, you take too much upon yourselves, seeing that the whole congregation is holy. We've heard that too. That's not something that only happened in the Old Testament. That's something that's still used today of individuals. Seeing that the whole congregation, or that all the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them, why do you lift yourselves up above the congregation of the Lord? Years ago, after the Feast of Tabernacles, had an individual call me and say, why does somebody always have to be in charge at the feast? Why can't we all just decide and pick a site and everybody just contribute what they want to the feast? Why does somebody have to be in charge? And I thought of this verse. Why have you put somebody over us? And I said, well, who's going to get the feast site together? Who's going to make arrangements? Who's going to do all these things? Well, we have people that do that. And I said, but wouldn't that be putting somebody over something to make it happen? I said, you can't have everybody doing their own thing and expect it to turn out the same way. But why do we have to have someone over us? And others have used this very phrase, the whole congregation is holy. God's called us holy. He set us apart. He said we're sanctified. So we all have the same voice in things. Today we see that sometimes in the church. We are all holy. But it's God who placed individuals in leadership positions within the church as it pleases Him. I plan to talk about leadership and church structure sometime soon as well. We have members who have boldly said in fewer words or less, the church isn't teaching the truth. I've discovered something and nobody else is teaching it. You need to listen to me. And again, you have all these things that come and go throughout the years, and eventually they may draw people with them and then it all fizzes out and you don't see them or hear from them anymore. But God has set some in the church, and the children of Israel, it was Moses and Aaron. Moses didn't want to do the job. He didn't say, make me the leader. Or he didn't decide on himself and go, you know what, I'm going to lead the children of Israel out of Egypt and hope God backs me up with some miracles. God chose him and picked him to do a job. And he set them above the people. So when Moses heard it, Moses got all upset and said, don't you realize I'm in charge? No, that's not what he did. He fell upon his face. He was humble, and he went before God and he said, this is not good. He had a right attitude. These were leaders of Israel, and they didn't like what Moses and Aaron were doing. And they took it upon themselves to change the situation. Let's get some support behind us. And again, it's always a dangerous thing to do. God doesn't like that attitude, and almost always it is stopped very quickly. The people of Corinth even challenged Paul in several cases about his authority. And Paul reminds the Corinthians that it's a special privilege to be in the service of God and in God's presence. And there's no guarantee and there's no promise of security, of success, or that God says, no matter what you do, things are going to go well. No, he said it's a special privilege and it is a purpose that God has done. Let's go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, and we'll pick up in verse 11. He repeats it again. After going through and explaining to the Corinthian church, don't follow these negative examples. Don't follow what the Israelites did. And even in their day, addressing some particular things, he says it again. Now all these things happened unto them for examples, and they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come. Now, Paul was saying, upon whom the ends of the world are come. Here we are, a couple thousand years later, realizing that the end of the world is near, the end of this age. And as we sit here on the first holy day of Feast of Unleavened Bread, 2019, we live in a world that is on the edge of the cliff. They're on the edge. The world is on the edge of major changes taking place. It's about to come crashing down, and things are about to become very different from what the world has known. The world economy is failing, and no matter what country or what area, you go to Europe, you go to Australia, you go to Asia, economies are struggling. We see natural disasters. nuclear weapons and the threat of nuclear warfare has increased. What we have seen the most in this country is moral decline and how it continues to rapidly go downhill. And if you read about the fall of Rome and some of the things that caused the fall of Rome, a lot of it began, and historians say, it was due to the moral decline of Rome that led to what took place and why Rome fell. What are the end-time characteristics of Egypt? He said this is going to happen to them until the end time. The same problems were going on in Corinth, along with many others, and we still face them today. We'd have to take the examples and bring them forward 2,000 years to today's society. Those same problems are there. The children of Israel murmured and complained, and today we have murmurs and complainers. They fell into idolatry and wanted something that they could visually see. They weren't happy with the miracles around them because they couldn't see the miracles or couldn't remember the miracles that took place. They fell into immoral behavior. And that was happening in Corinth, and it happens today. The lust for evil things, and he said, don't lust as they lusted, is still there. And Satan tries to make things look pleasurable. Even as it says that Moses chose to be with God, even giving up the pleasures of sin for a season. It was pleasurable, but it's only for a season. And in many cases, we know things are wrong, but sometimes the human mind will rationalize and come up with ideas of why something may not be wrong or why it shouldn't be wrong. And we find a way to lust for things that we want. Temptations of idolatry are still strong. Some physically don't worship idols in the strictest sense. Some still do. But man's gods are those things which he dedicates himself to in what takes our time, our thoughts, and our energy. If our focus is on something in particular and you go, I spend a lot of time doing this, but I enjoy it, or it's my job, but our thoughts are there, our energy is there, that's what we wake up thinking about, it's what our focus is on, that can become a god. People today worship the works of their hands more than they worship God. How do we spend our time, and where are our thoughts and our interests? You know, it says seek in Matthew 6:33, seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. How often do we really think about that as being the number one priority? Do we pray about that in the morning? Do we ask God, bring your kingdom soon? I'm focused on your kingdom. I want it to come because this world is getting worse and worse. Or do we find ourselves going a couple months and going, oh, you know, I haven't even thought about the kingdom very often. Where are our thoughts and our interests? The temptation to sexual immorality is greater than it has been before. We're bombarded constantly. Not only is Satan filling the airways and TV, media, advertising, music, books, even news, is filled with it. Today, opportunities are everywhere to indulge in it. And of course, the internet has increased access to it, and people can do it and feel like they're doing it without being seen, because they don't believe God is watching. Tempting Christ is still one of our defense mechanisms as human beings. Blaming God or blaming Christ when things don't go as we think they should. How could a God allow this? How could Jesus Christ, if he knows what's going on, allow this to happen and begin to murmur and complain against God or against Christ? Where they ask, what happened to God? Where is he? Why doesn't he help me? I've asked for it over and over, and he's not answering my prayer. It's like saying, where's the water? Where's quail? We want meat. We're tired of this light bread. We want meat. Americans today specialize in grumbling, complaining. We want to complain, we want to criticize, we want to find fault, whether it's
with an institution, whether it's with a person, we want to point the finger and blame somebody else or blame each other. People like to blame leaders, and sadly that happens even within the church. Oh, the church is the way it is because of the leaders. And we've heard that even recently. All the churches have problems because it's the leaders. And if we get rid of all the leaders, who's left? Well, the people who are complaining and trying to get people to follow them, who become the new leaders and new problems. But God hates the attitude of grumbling and complaining. It's the opposite of a converted mind, which is humble and teachable. It's opposite of the mind that Moses had when they complained against him and Aaron and said, "Who made you to rule over us?" Says he fell on his face. He humbled himself before God and asked God to take care of the situation. Much of news today is griping and complaining or finding fault, trying to find something, bringing up dirt on another individual, and even networks coming up with fake news is becoming the common phrase of trying to make things look bad. Philippians chapter 4 and verse 8. I don't want to focus just on what we are to remove. We are to keep and keep all of this old leaven, the old way of life, the old thinking, all of the things we've just covered, we're to keep out. Philippians 4:8 gives us a list of positive things that we are to put in, the things that help us to be unleavened. It says, "Finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, and whatsoever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there be any virtue, if there be any praise, think on these things." This is where our focus needs to be. We've been de-leavened. We are unleavened after we've come through the Passover, the night to be much observed, and here we are on the first day out of seven of being unleavened. It's where our focus needs to be. And during the days of unleavened bread, we need to know where our focus is. What are the intents? What are the thoughts? Having this knowledge that God has given to us is a miracle. For God to open the mind, and I read examples of personal correspondence letters of individuals whose minds are being opened. They still have a lot of unanswered questions. But I can read you others who have said, the more I read of the literature, the more I understand, the more I want to know. Do you have a church that I can go to? Is there more information that I can receive? It's exciting to see the opening of a mind. And God has blessed us with that miracle. To have our eyes open to the truth and to be given biblical knowledge and understanding. And much of the world doesn't have that available to them. We know that we are living in the last days. We know that there are difficult times ahead. Perilous times, it says, are coming. Are we going to be ready? Are we going to be vigilant? And are we going to be on guard? Satan is going to attack us at our weakest point. Paul went through and explained to the Corinthians there are several areas we need to learn not to make the same mistakes as the Israelites. And he pointed out idolatry, adultery, to not boast and be proud. He focused on particular areas to be on guard. And again, if we're weak in an area or overconfident in an area, then that may be a weak link. And again, we're not impervious to the attacks of Satan. I've heard members of organizations say, "Well, we're the group that's doing everything right." Look up, wait for that lightning bolt to come down. We're doing it all right. When we're not. We know we make mistakes. But we're focused on doing it right, and we want to do it right. We want to realize, though, there is always room for growth and change. And that we're not special doing it right better than anybody else and have that pride and be boasting. Again, we're told in the end times, individuals are going to be lovers of their own selves. I've got it. I've got it together. I've got everything I need. Or as I mentioned, this year was so easy, I didn't have a whole lot I had to focus on overcoming. A sad state to be in. But people are filled with themselves, their looks, their wants, their life, what fills their time. Sometimes it's their knowledge. I've grown in knowledge so much that I should be teaching these things. And in some cases, as Paul said, you should be teachers. But he said, I can't even give you the milk. We can't ever get to the point where we say, I've got it together. I have everything I need. We have to beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, aware of the leaven of the Corinthians, and the traits of Egypt that God said, this is what brought them to the point where many of them died in the wilderness. I want to go back and look at what Paul says and finish up in Corinthians. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and in verse 12. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 12. He says this again. He says, wherefore let him that thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. Goes back to the attitude of pride. He says, don't ever get to the point where you go, I'm in good standing. Let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. There is no temptation taken you such as is common to man, but God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that which you are able, but will with temptation also make a way of escape that you can be able to bear it. Wherefore, my dearly beloved, flee from idolatry. So he goes back and says, don't ever think, oh, I'm above idolatry. I'm not going to worship idols. He said, beware if you think you stand, because sometimes you can worship an idol without even realizing it or justify it. That is the most time-consuming thing. That is where your thoughts and your mind are. He says, let him that thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. And he goes back again to fleeing idolatry. He concludes this part of the lesson in Corinthians, and he warns them to beware. Confidence in the flesh or in our own ability is disastrous. Or thinking, I did this, I've done what I should through the examination process, and I was able to overcome this on my own. He says, don't have confidence in your own ability. We have to have faith in God the Father and Jesus Christ, who we just came through the process of renewing that covenant relationship with at Passover. And then not developing faith in ourselves that, oh, I've got it together, I've got what I need, I can make these changes, because we can't. So many things have taken the lives of individuals who let their guard down and got their focus on something wrong. Israel had a lack of faith and a lack of believing in God. They saw the miracles, and many people today, how come we don't see the miracles? Well, they saw them and still did not believe God or commit themselves to Him. And they wouldn't obey God. They said, all that you have said we will do. And we say, they forgot the Lord their God, and they went right back to making the same mistakes. It's interesting, the days of unleavened bread begin with Passover, where we go back to looking and realizing, I cannot do this without Jesus Christ. I have to have Him living His life in me. And we put our trust confidently in Him that we are cleansed of sin and that He can now live in us. And we recommit ourselves at baptism. Are we going to be examples for others to follow? Paul was preaching to the Corinthians, and he says, we have to learn from their examples. I'm asking you today, what example are you going to leave? Will we have our stories written in a continuation of the book of Acts? Many have thought that someday there may be more added to the book of Acts, the church, what happened in the last 2,000 years. It's an interesting thought. It may happen. What's even more interesting is when we think of it on a personal level, what would be written about you and I? our trials, our difficulties. We see the life of individuals revealed in minute detail. King David, Apostle Paul, individuals who stood out but had their faults revealed. Could some of our victories and some of our failures be listed as examples of the end time church? Now, many, if we knew it was going to be written, I think many people would go, okay, I got to be on the straight and narrow. But, oh, it's a possibility. I don't think it's ever going to be written. Let the guard down. What would be said about the church today? How much of our grumbling and criticizing would be mentioned? How much of it would be recorded? And if it were recorded, would we do things differently? If we knew it was being recorded every time you grumbled and complained, to have it written down of you, and you can put your name in, so-and-so complained and grumbled about traffic on the way to church every week. Or they grumbled and complained about not having specific things that they wanted. I wouldn't want that written. And we have to think of it in that way, that it is being written, it's being seen, it's being recorded, and God knows what's taking place. Will it be said that even though they lived in a time when the world was consumed with physical things, they kept their eyes and their minds on the work that God was doing and on focusing on the kingdom of God? Now we'd say, oh yeah, that's what I would like to have written about me. Then we have to live it. Could be said that we were consumed by the world, by the glamour, by the power, and were caught up in it. There may be stories of success, of individuals proving all things and holding fast and hearing those words, well done, now good and faithful servant. Those who became unleavened, which is the purpose of this week. He said, this is so you are unleavened. Other examples may be given of those who were deceived, consumed by their appetite for the world and worldly things, and were led astray. Revelation warns us, come out of her, my people, and don't be partakers of her ways. The world is easy to become a part of. It's easy to fit in. I want to look at one more passage in concluding. Hebrews chapter 4. Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 11. Hebrews 4 and verse 11, it says, let us labor, therefore, to enter into that rest. Talking about the physical rest, but talking about a spiritual rest in the future. Lest any man fail after the same example of unbelief. Israel failed to believe. They failed to have a firm belief and trust. They had a lack of faith. Many disobeyed and forfeited the opportunity to enter into the promised land. And faith and obedience go hand in hand. We are obedient. We follow the laws of God. We follow what God has commanded us because we believe. Today we stand where Israel stood and where the Corinthians stood as Paul was preaching to them on the Feast of Unleavened Bread. We are freed from sin, free from bondage. We have been unleavened and cleansed. We are poised to move forward towards the kingdom of God, as they then had the opportunity to move from there to begin their march toward the promised land. We have to be diligent to enter the kingdom of God or that rest, and we don't want to fall short as they did. Verse 14, they that say such things declare plainly, they seek a country. They sought something. And truly, if they had been mindful of the country from where they came out, they might have had opportunity to have returned. We've come out of spiritual Egypt. There's an opportunity to go right back into it. But we have to be aware and mindful so we don't. Verse 16, but now they desire a better country, that is a heavenly. Their focus is on the kingdom of God. Wherefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city. He's not ashamed. He said, God looked back and with the children of Israel, and he said he was disappointed because of their unbelief and their griping and the grumbling and complaining and their blaming of Jesus Christ. But here he says he's not ashamed to be called their God because they have focused on the better country. The help and the need that we have to succeed is available. God will provide what we need to be successful. But we have to have that access to the Father and to Jesus Christ. We're here on the first day of Unleavened Bread. And I ask the question, as we begin 7 days of remaining unleavened, what do we do now? Let us keep this feast in an unleavened manner. We have to work on our lives, removing the attitudes of leaven. And we should have seen those attitudes when we do the self-examination. And as we continue this week, it is a focus on attitude. We ask God to help us to be positive examples to those who are behind us. As I said in Philippians, focusing on the things that are good, pure, right, we have to continue in that direction. And we have to take in what is unleavened. It's not just avoiding leaven. Okay, I won't eat donuts, I won't eat bread, I won't eat a hamburger, I won't eat an ice cream cone. That happened 1 year. A group of us traveling, and so we stopped and we go. It was in Oklahoma. It's one of the largest McDonald's, and it covers the interstate. It's a bridge that covers the interstate, and McDonald's sits on this bridge. And we were traveling back from Tulsa to Joplin. Well, we can't get burgers. Well, let's just get ice cream. Some of us got sundaes, and some got cones. We get back in the car. We're driving, and as they're eating, they're like, oh, it's an ice cream cone. Yeah, it didn't get a burger, but you got an ice cream cone. We have to avoid not just what's unleavened, but trying to take in unleavened bread every day as a reminder. This is the week we are focused on being unleavened ourselves and developing a habit of looking at godly traits and what needs to be in our lives so that we remain unleavened. And that we become unleavened. Paul says, let us keep this feast, not with leavening, not with the leavening of negative attitudes and things that can destroy us. But he said, let us keep this feast, the 7 days that are ahead of us, with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth.